Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey everyone, thanks so much for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to have you with me. You know, we have a wide variety of interesting guests here on the show. Today, I think you're going to be very interested in taking some notes. My first guest is Ariel Garten, and she's probably one of the most interesting people you will ever meet. She's a neuroscientist, a mom, a former psychotherapist, former fashion designer, and the co-founder and visionary of an amazing and highly effective tech startup called Muse, which tracks your brain during meditation to give you real-time feedback on your meditation, guiding you into the zone and solving the problem that most of us have when we're starting to practice meditation. Muse lets you know when you're doing it right. And with no formal business background, Ariel personally raised $18 million to found Muse from Silicon Valley investors, as well as Ashton Kutcher. And Muse is now used by hundreds of thousands of people to start or deepen their meditation practice, including by Mayo Clinic. And when Ariel's not reading brains, literally, or investing in, inspiring, and advising other startups and women in business, you can find her on stages across the world from TED to MIT, teaching audiences about their brain and how to overcome its limitations, consistently giving her audiences the practical tools and insights they need to help them become their best selves. Now, Ariel and Muse have been featured in over 1,000 articles, including CNN, Forbes, Fortune, Popular Science, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, GQ, Men's Health, O Magazine, Wired, quite a few organizations. And Ariel's mission in life is to help people understand how their brain and mind work, both the nuts and bolts and neurons, and how that plays out in the messy and beautiful human experience of living. She inspires people to understand that they can accomplish anything they want by understanding what actually goes on in their own mind. And I should also note that Ariel's also the co-host of Untangle podcast. So with all of that, Ariel, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Hello. Thank you so much. It's a joy and a pleasure to be here.
That's quite an introduction. It's an amazing a collection of things that you have done in life, and to bring you to this incredible journey you're on now with Muse, which really, I guess it sounds like, helps a lot of people do what they wonder about. How do I make my meditation most effective? Tell us a little bit more about that and your startup experience.
Sure. So I formed Muse as a startup over a decade ago. It was literally three friends coming together, figuring out how we could make the world a better place with the technology that I was working with in a laboratory. And we had this technology that used EEG and let you know when you were focused and when your mind was wandering, when you were relaxed. And we took that technology and we realized that we could solve a big problem that people have, which is how do they meditate? Because we all know meditation is incredibly good for you, but it's really hard to do. There's no like little coach or guru sitting inside your head telling you when to meditate and if you're doing it right and what to do. And so with this technology, we could actually let you hear the sound of your mind, hear when you're focused and hear when your mind is wandering, and really give you real-time feedback to be able to understand either how to start your meditation practice or give you deeper insight to improve your practice. And that's how Muse was born.
Very interesting. Well, you found an interesting niche. And, you know, I think of the new cars that have the lane correct technology, and then when you wander out of your lane, sounds something like that. I want to hear all about how that works. But first, let's back up and talk to our audience who might not be really familiar about what is meditation Why does it work, and what happens in the brain when we meditate?
Sure. So meditation is a practice or a training that you do regularly to lead to healthy and positive mind states. So in the same way that we go to the gym to train and improve our bodies and keep them strong, meditation helps us train and improve our brain and keep it both focused as well as more relaxed. In a basic meditation, what you're doing is you are putting your attention on your breath. When your mind wanders away from your breath, you notice that your mind has wandered, and then you choose to bring your attention back to your breath. Now, this sounds like a very simple process, attention on breath, mind wander, notice, return, but it actually leads to some really profound transformations. What you do when you notice that your mind has wandered and then choose to come back to your breath is, first of all, you're noticing your mind. So most of us just go through the world filled with thoughts in our head, and we assume the thoughts are supposed to be there, the thoughts of I'm not good enough and I need to go to the grocery store and blah, blah, blah. In meditation, what you learn to do is observe the process of your thinking and then make a choice about the thoughts that you want to have there. And so when you do this, this actually makes us much less stressed because you can notice, oh, I'm having a stressful thought. I don't actually want to be thinking about this right now. And it gives you a process where you can take your mind off that thought and put it on something else. And so this leads to a much better mental state. It also leads to a much better physical state. So the practice of meditation lowers your heart rate, relaxes your body, improves your stress levels. And there are now literally over 1,000 published studies demonstrating meditation's ability to improve your overall health, reduce the incidences of disease, improve your focus and your attention and your cognitive function, and even make your brain look younger.
How long should someone attempt to meditate, or is it something that you kind of work your way up, like if you're going to run a marathon, you start with a trip around the block? What's the ideal time to meditate if there is one?
Sure. So a lot of the studies looking at meditation have shown that 20 minutes a day has significant impact. In the studies that we've done with Muse, and there have now been over 200 published studies using Muse, it looks like 10 minutes a day leads to significant impact. So meditating with Muse for 10 minutes a day has shown improvements in cognitive function, decrease in stress, improvements in your body's markers of health. And it's something that you just start easy and work your way up. You can start as little as 3 or 5 minutes a day. And then when you become comfortable with the practice, work your way up to 10. And like going to the gym, it's something that you want to be doing regularly. And the more you do it, the more you learn the practice, the more it becomes a part of your life, and then it just becomes natural to be able to have better cognitive control and better relaxation and health in your body.
And let me ask you a question, because a lot of our business owner listeners are type A, very driven, very goal-oriented people. And so I've heard and read
Sounds
about
like me.
Things where... Yeah, where you know, you give your mind something to work on when you meditate, but that's not really the goal of meditation, right? It's to, you know what I'm talking about? I've even read things where you should always have something for your mind to work on before you go to sleep. That's not always healthy, right?
Yes, our minds don't always need to work. And when you meditate, you end up in a mental space that's actually much healthier for your brain. So when we look at markers for brain health, one of the markers for brain health is your alpha peak frequency. And this is a brain frequency that you are in when you are focused and relaxed. It's also brain frequency that you're in before you fall asleep. And it's a very relaxed brain state. Being in this brain state is actually really healthy for your brain. It's not a brain state of, you know, thinking, cogitating, working. It's just a state of being like in simple, pure, relaxed focus. So being a type A person myself, I totally kind of identify with this idea that maybe you don't want to be doing nothing, but rest assured that when you're meditating, you are not doing nothing. In the focused attention meditation, which is the one I told you about earlier, where you're focusing on your breath, what you're actually doing in that moment is you're building the muscle of your attention. You're being able to maintain your focus on one thing, and you're learning to observe the process of your thinking. So it's not doing nothing. It's something that is actually a really hard skill to build. It's something that you're working on while you're doing it. And it actually leads you to be significantly more productive because it helps you identify your mind wandering and distraction throughout the day and then be able to come back to the task at hand, the thing you're focusing on, much more effectively.
Yeah, so with that, you know, what I was thinking of was maybe there is a goal to meditation, but it's not to work on a problem. It's perhaps just maybe to say, I'm going to take 20 minutes to, let's say, reset my soul, reset my thinking, reset my brain. Would that be a
yes.
reason? Because, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, I need something to come out of this, like you said. I need a goal orientation. What would you say would be a good thought for, okay, why am I going to do this?
Sure, there's a lot that's going to come out of it. So you can increase your productivity, you can decrease your stress, you can increase your attention, you can increase your cognitive function. So in tests that we've done of people doing Muse for 10 minutes a day for 6 weeks, we see improvement in something called the Strip Task, which shows that you become faster at making decisions with conflicting information under stressful situations. So, you know, this 10 or 20 minutes that you're spending is not for naught. It actually leads to significant improvements in your life. It also helps become a better leader, a better communicator, a better listener, a better friend and human. You know, the benefits are dramatic.
From people that you talk to, and you've talked to a lot of people about this, do you recommend that they find a time in the, you know, first part of the day when things are peaceful, or say midday when things are most chaotic, to take time off to come back and be charged up to deal with things? Or is end of the day, or is it just different for everyone?
Yeah, the right time to meditate is the time that works for you. So it's something that you want to be doing regularly. So you want to find the time that you can build it into your own routine. And just like any habit, as soon as it becomes routine, that's when it's now part of your daily life and you do it with regularity. We find with Muse, a lot of people do it at 6 a.m. It's one of the most popular times. Lots of people do it in the middle of the day, taking a break. And we also have a lot of people that would use Muse before they went to bed to help them quiet their mind and fall asleep.
Excellent, because I know a lot of notable big thinkers like Benjamin Franklin used to take a lot of naps. Well, maybe he was really meditating during that time frame. We don't know, right? So anyways,
it could be.
Let's talk about how to overcome, you know, our brains tell us so many different things during the day, and let's talk about that, how to overcome what your brain tells you, the neuroscience of anxiety, which you are very familiar with, and fear and bias and how to overcome them. Give us some tips.
Sure. So let's step back and sort of look into the brain and see what happens when we're in a space of negativity. So you have an organ inside your head called the amygdala, and the amygdala's job is to look for things that could be dangerous for you. And some of those are real dangers, like, you know, fires, and some of those are perceived dangers, like people who may not like us or a wrinkle that we have in our pants before we go into a meeting. And our amygdala's job is to represent this, you know, dangerous information to us over and over and over and over and over again to make sure we pay attention. And that's why as humans, we have a negativity bias, because we're always trying to, thanks to our amygdala, you know, pay attention to the dangers again and again and again. Now, this can be incredibly useful in life and business, but often this part of our brain becomes over-functional. And that's where we get anxiety. That's where we get stress. That's where we get repeated negative thinking where it's no longer helpful or useful to us. So in a meditation practice, what we're actually doing is we're strengthening a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is the front of the brain, and it's the part of our brain associated with decision-making, attention, inhibition, organization, planning. It's the part of our brain that really makes us a higher human. And in meditation, what you see is that the prefrontal cortex is actually able to quiet the amygdala. It's actually able to reduce its activity and to have it say, you know, it's okay, everything's okay, please stop. You know those moments when you're stuck in traffic and, you know, you have the, oh no, I'm stuck in traffic, and your amygdala spikes,
right?
And it's like, I'm going to be late for this, or I'm stuck in traffic, and then your heart goes, and then you're, you know, your heart is beating and you're sweaty, but you're stuck in traffic. There's nothing you can do about it. And you kind of try to move your mind away, but then every 3 minutes you're like, oh man, this traffic. And you're actually just ruining your day for no reason. And that time is no longer productive when you could be sitting there like thinking at least or learning. Well,
mm-hmm.
That's
yep.
the amygdala. Yep. Yep, that's the amygdala turning your mind to the negative, turning your mind to the thing that's wrong, activating your body, giving you the heart palpitations, the anxiety, when it's no longer helpful to you. And so what we as evolved humans can do is use our big prefrontal cortexes, look around at the scenario, say, yes, you know, I'm stuck in traffic, but I'm safe. I know how to drive this car. It's fine. I'll get there eventually, and there's nothing I can do. So the best thing to do would be amygdala, shh, be quiet, like body, stop sweating, chill out. You know, let's put on a podcast or listen to something that's going to be helpful or run a meeting, you know, from the car. And so what we as humans have this ability to do is to really make choices about how we want to think and how we want to act. And that's really the process that meditation teaches you. It teaches you to observe your own reactions and then to be able to quiet your mind and body when your reactions aren't actually aligning to what is best for you in that moment.
Interesting. Yeah, it's it is interesting how complex our our mind structure, our the developed mind structure is, and I've also heard that the prefrontal cortex is small and it gets tired if you focus. So sometimes you need to give it some rest and a break to most effectively use it. Have you heard that as well? Do you know that as well?
Yeah, so your prefrontal, so this is an interesting thing. Our brains get tired, so we want to give them breaks, absolutely. But we also want to make sure that we use our brain, because the more you use it, the prefrontal cortex, as you age, actually thins. But if you're able to do things like a long-term meditation practice, you can maintain the thickness of your prefrontal cortex even as you age. So it's like, you know, any muscle, yes, our muscles get tired, and so we want to make sure that we rest our muscles, but you also want to make sure that you're working your muscles so that they stay strong. So it becomes a balance of activities throughout our day that both work and rest.
Interesting. So how can mindfulness and meditation be used for leadership development? Let's talk about that for a few minutes.
Sure. So as leaders, it is our job to be able to rise above a situation and survey the landscape and see the vision in the future and the organization that's in front of us and be able to make smart decisions. So when we are, you know, pulled by our fears, it's really hard to make smart decisions. So meditation teaches you the practice, just like I described, you could, you know, rise above your thoughts and observe your thoughts. So too, can you rise above a scenario and observe what's going on in the whole scenario and then be able to make better judgments about what's driven by your fears and what is in there in reality. Meditation actually strengthens a part of our brain called the temporal parietal junction that's responsible for compassion, empathy, and perspective taking, the ability to shift perspective. So this both allows us to assess, you know, a landscape of what to do and also to build better relationships with our staff. As leaders, being able to be aware of your own drive, the things that, you know, push you, and then to be able to understand those impacts on the people around us and then make better choices about our own actions and behaviors is really, really key. And so meditation
really
teaches you that skill. Yeah.
Now, Ariel, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you how a little bit more about Muse and how it, just basically how it works. We've only got a couple minutes left, but I'd love to, for our audience to understand a little bit more about it, and then we'll tell them how to learn more about where to find it.
Sure. So Muse is really like a tracker, like a Fitbit, but instead of being on your wrist, it's on your forehead, and it's a slim little device that tracks your brain during meditation, and it gives you real-time feedback to know when you're focused and when your mind is wandering. Lets you know in real time what's going on in your mind, and then it also gives you data after the fact so you can see the improvement that you're making in your meditation. And as I said earlier, it really solves that problem of like, what am I doing? Am I doing it right? And for those goal-directed, you know, goal-oriented people, it really helps you improve. It really shows you that you're on the path to getting better at your meditation. We also have a huge library of content on workplace-associated meditations, performance, sleep. And then we have a new device that just came out that actually helps you fall asleep and stay asleep, and also is able to track your sleep through the night as precisely as a sleep lab.
Ariel, as advertised, you are one of the most interesting people I've ever met. So very good. Very good job on telling our audience. It's a very interesting topic, I think, for a lot of people who are under a lot of stress these days and trying to be better and trying to be better, you know, use their minds better. Now, the website for the audience is www.choosemuse.com/welcome. And you'll find more information about Muse, the information that we've talked about, and a discount code is Choose Muse. So please look that up. And Ariel, I want to thank you very much, and I wish you the best of luck with your product. I think I'll be checking that out, and I hope our audience will as well. And I hope you'll come back and tell us how it's going, maybe in a few months down the road. And very interesting. It sounds like you have some great ideas that you're coming to market with as time goes by.
Thank you so much. It was my joy and pleasure, and happy to connect any other time.
Thanks very much for putting up with my voice today. I'm overcoming a non-COVID thing, but I'll be okay. But I really appreciate you coming on and bearing with me and sharing your information. Very, very interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening out there today. I really appreciate you being with me today. And as promised, we have a great lineup of guests. And my next guest is Channing Hamlet, and we're going to talk about common mistakes that business owners make that impact the sale of their company, both the valuation and success of the sale. Channing Hamlet is Managing Director of Objective, a leading investment banking and valuation firm, and he oversees the robust appraisal practice, which conducts more than 200 appraisals per year and leads execution for investment banking transactions. And he will rely on experience and case studies today to highlight areas that business owners should consider when selling their business in order to improve the saleability and valuation of their business. Channing, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm interested in hearing about this. One of the, you know, big questions these days is, you know, how do I make my business more attractive and more saleable to a buyer, because there's a lot of competition out there. So tell us more about Objective and what you do and how you all help folks.
Yeah. Objective is a firm. We primarily offer two services. One service that we provide is business appraisal, and that includes a whole combination of compliance activities, whether it's stock option valuations, estate and gift tax planning, or other valuations that support tax. We do a fair amount of valuation for financial reporting, including purchase price allocations, asset impairment, and other fair value to support balance sheets. And the third thing we do in appraisal is work with business owners to help them understand the value of their business, to either prepare for a transaction or to begin thinking about how to improve their value. And so the appraisal service is one element of what we do. The second element of what we do is sell side investment banking, where we represent business owners beginning to end through the sale of their company, from doing our own due diligence and homework up front, creating the materials, creating the list of buyers that we want to go to, and really positioning the company to achieve maximum value, and then running a competitive auction process in terms of engaging multiple buyers and getting them to compete with each other to get our clients not only the best price, but the best terms.
Well, boy, are you in the right place. We're fascinated about this topic, of course, always wanted to learn more about how to make our businesses more saleable, attractive to a buyer. Can you talk a little bit before we get into the meat of the matter about what the environment is like now? Is it a seller's market or a buyer's market? And how strong is the competition out there for people like you? And maybe tell us a little bit in terms of how many deals you look at before you say yes, we'll take you on.
Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, in the heat of battle of COVID, the M&A market is a little bit tricky. And as you know, there have been sort of winners and losers in terms of how COVID and some of the economic challenges have impacted different companies. And so in representing a seller and looking to sell a business in the current economic environment, I think having a keen awareness and understanding of how the business was impacted by COVID either positively or negatively, and having an opinion and view and outlook on where the business is going as the economy and society normalizes from COVID is kind of a key element. But what we've seen over the last couple of years is there's an enormous amount of capital that's come into the market. You know, strategic buyers have sort of more cash than they've ever had. Their growth rates have been lower given the lower economic growth during this expansion cycle. And so strategic buyers are aggressively looking for acquisitions to drive growth. The second thing that we've seen, and this is a long-term trend, and it's occurred over the 25 years that I've been doing investment banking work, is that the amount of money that's gone into private equity has continued to expand and expand and expand. And so, you know, what we're seeing is that during COVID, the number of companies that are actively looking to sell has come down a little bit, you know, particularly driven by companies that were impacted by COVID, not either wanting to sell during a time when their financials are down or not being able to because their business and industry has uncertainty. And so what we're seeing right now is there's a supply and demand imbalance of good deals. And so good companies are, it's definitely a seller's market because the capital, both on the strategic side and the private equity side, is still there. And there are fewer transactions. And so for companies that are in good shape to sell right now, it's definitely a seller's market.
Good. That's good to hear, and that's really good insight, and makes a lot of sense. I mean, it makes a lot of sense on the financial side because, you know, let's face it, it's hard to make a buck in traditional investments out there. So a lot more people are saying, well, I'm going to see if we can buy a business and improve our ROI. And then on the other side of things, like you said, a lot of business owners have maybe thought, well, there's not as much E in my EBITDA, so I'm not going to get enough to make, you know, it worthwhile, and maybe they're shying away in a strategic market. That might be a mistake.
Exactly.
Love it. So let's talk about what is the most common factor that impacts the saleability of a company. We have a lot of owners out there that say, you know, I might just get one shot at this. I want to make sure that I win the beauty contest. What makes me saleable and attractive to a buyer?
Yeah, when we look at companies, we really look at a couple of different elements. One thing we look at is, what is the company worth in terms of value drivers? And then the second thing that we look for is the company saleable? And so the thing that we've seen over the years is oftentimes business owners that run private companies have gotten comfortable with some kind of systemic risk or concentration in their business, whether it's concentration and reliance on a key vendor, reliance on, you know, a key employee, reliance on a key customer where there's a concentration of risk, or there are sloppy processes and procedures. And so a business owner in a smaller private company that can get comfortable operating a successful company with one or more of these kind of risks, but a buyer, whether it's a public company or a private equity firm that manages institutional capital, is not really in a position to take these types of risks. And so oftentimes we see great businesses, but they have one or more kind of, quote, fatal flaws that created an obstacle to a sale. Just a quick example, we worked with a family-owned company that was very successful, and they had an offer on the table from a public company into the high eight figures. And uh-huh. as the buyer got into due diligence, it became clear that there were some questions about the ownership of the intellectual property and who actually owned and had rights to the intellectual property. And this is a family-owned business that had been operating for multiple generations, very successful, making a lot of money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. the buyer that was engaged was a public company. The board of directors of a public company, in looking at making an investment in this private company, isn't able to take sort of a large risk on the integrity of the intellectual property. And so the company, the public company, was sort of forced to walk away from this deal. It wasn't a matter of value. It wasn't a matter of price. It was just a matter of a risk that they couldn't accept. And so often we see companies that have some kind of very significant systemic risk that really creates an impact or creates an obstacle to a sale. And that's sort of, you know, to sum up the answer to the question, it's really, you know, encouraging business owners to think through where they have concentrations of risk in their business and work on putting risk mitigation strategies in place.
Yeah, really good point. It could be suppliers. It could be customer concentration. It could be employees that know everything and could, you know, leave the company without a lot of its key knowledge. It could be the owner
exactly.
is too important to the day-to-day operation. That happens a lot, right? In smaller businesses, the owner has not decentralized what they do enough. So that's a great category with a lot of tentacles in it throughout a business. What are the biggest risks? How do you de-risk your business? And you hit on one really big one. What else comes to mind when you think about the saleability of the company and another common factor that might impact the sale?
You know, you hit on a lot of important elements there. There's two other things that really come to mind. Often small companies can get by with cutting corners as far as employment law or licensing in their industry, or having every T crossed and every I dotted as far as compliance, because they fly under the radar screen of regulatory agencies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, in selling to a private equity firm or a public company, you know, those types of companies can't afford to take those types of risks. And so I think a lot of times business owners of private companies underestimate the level of compliance and really the elements of following the rules. And so really taking a hard look at that and knowing that private equity firms and strategic buyers really hold a high bar in terms of compliance with all the rules and regulations. We've seen issues with that time and time again. And the other thing you brought up is really worth emphasizing. Many times business owners are really key individuals in the operation of a business. It's hard for a buyer to buy their business for 100% cash up front, knowing that the key individual could have significantly less motivation to keep working hard because they can now afford to be on the golf course or on their yacht or on their private island or what have you. And so there's this a little bit of a misconception among business owners that we see where they think their business is easy to run. They think the buyer is going to show up with a new management team and have a seamless transition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Buyers look at management transitions as very, very risky. And so one of the things that makes a company saleable is really having a strong management succession plan in place so that the owner or owners that are selling can point to the operating management team that's going to be excited about working with the new buyer and continuing to, you know, grow and build the business under new ownership. And really getting that formula right is a key factor in having a company that can be sold and can be sold for cash up front or upfront consideration.
And it sounds like that, you know, that comes down to, yeah, not only do you have key people in place, but you have your processes and systems in place so that if a new management team does have to come in, they can pick up and, you know, hit the ground running with a good detailed set of systems and processes to work from, right? So in case the key people do end up leaving, they're not hampered by that.
Exactly.
Really good points. Good points. So how do you guys identify key value drivers of a company?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there isn't necessarily a one-size-fits-all answer. And, you know, you don't need to interview someone to tell you that, you know, having more revenue or more profit makes the business more valuable. And so what we've learned over the years is that every industry and every company is unique in what truly drives the value of a company. And so we try to step back and look at who are the buyers of a company? What acquisitions have they made in the past? How were those valued? And what are the sort of strategic elements of those deals? And to try to identify value drivers beyond just revenue and profit. And so, for example, in the software space, buyers are looking at a series of factors around the cost of customer acquisition, the level of recurring revenue, and the lifetime value of customers. And so the software companies that really manage to those three metrics and look at and pay attention and optimize their business around those three metrics would command more value than a software company that's not really optimized around those metrics. In early in my career, the security alarm industry was going through consolidation. And when we were working with security alarm companies and doing research in that space, it turned out that the buyers were buying companies that had and client retention, and the buyers weren't so concerned about profitability, operations, et cetera. And so two security alarm companies with the same revenue, one that was profitable, well-run, and very stable, the other that was kind of rapidly growing and had a strong client acquisition capability, but wasn't necessarily well-run and wasn't necessarily profitable, would actually be worth more in that environment because of what the strategic buyers are looking for and what the buyers are looking for. And so we really try to identify, you know, beyond sort of the fundamentals of the financials, what is it the buyers are looking for and what is it that is going to make the company valuable? And, you know, look at the next layer or the next two layers to work on that. And one of the things, early in my career, I worked for a private equity firm, and we bought about 25 companies while I worked there. And one of the things that we would do right after we made an investment in a company or an acquisition is we would sit down with the management team and map out with them what we thought the key 3 to 5 value drivers of the company were. And then we would ask management to report on those monthly. And we'd look at them with the management team on a regular basis. And one of the things that happened as we worked with the companies and got them to sort of focus on a few of the key value drivers, those companies focused on building value and built value, and our investments turned out well. It's a rare private company that I go to where I could sit down with the owner or the CEO and say, hey, what do you think the key value drivers of your company are, and are you managing to those? They don't think that way. They're not managing to the value drivers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so really taking the time to think through, you know, what are the 2 or 3 or 5 value drivers in my business? And, you know, mapping them out, putting goals in place with the management team and getting the whole company aligned around those can make a huge difference. And it's almost a crime that most private business owners aren't really looking at that and aren't really focused on that. It's a huge lost opportunity.
Good point. You need to really think about, well, what's your target buyer really looking for, and how do you look like that, as opposed to maybe being a jack of all trades, really focusing on those key things that are going to make you really attractive to that strategic buyer. Great, great points, Channing. We got about a minute left. Tell us a little bit about when should a business owner begin planning their exit. How far in advance?
Yeah, I mean, I think the short answer is it's never too early. to begin planning. And planning for an exit is a very complex, it's a very complex process, and it's a very complex and personal decision. And there are a number of both, you know, personal elements, family elements, financial elements, and business elements that all really need to come together to create a successful
right.
exit. And so advanced planning takes time, and building a team of advisors, you know, including a wealth manager, a CPA, attorney, you know, investment banker, et cetera, well in advance of the exit and really putting the pieces in place can be a significant ingredient in building the foundation of having a successful exit. And then when you do get a call one day and someone knocks on your door that wants to acquire your business, you know, you're ready and you can capitalize on the opportunity rather than being kind of caught flat-footed and scrambling.
Channing, really, really great points, really interesting information that you've shared with us today. And you offer a consultation with a managing director of Objective to assist with planning and execution of an exit strategy or development of business valuation. I think you can tell by listening to Channing that even if you just have a call with someone there, you're going to be in a better place understanding what you need to be doing to get ready for your exit. What's the best way? I know your website is ObjectiveCP. Objective, C as in Charlie, P as in Patrick, .com. Is that the best way for people to start learning about you and get in touch?
Yeah, exactly. The contact information, including phone number and email address for all of our managing directors is on the website, and any of us would be happy to talk to business owners that have questions about the sale process or are thinking about advanced planning. You know, we love to create relationships with great companies early and be helpful along the way and along their path to an ultimate exit and sale.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on today and share your great tips with us. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
Thank you for listening today. We really appreciate you being with us. My next guest is Wayne Mullins, and he's going to talk about three reasons that your gorgeous website may not actually be doing anything to grow your business. Wayne, how are you doing today? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing fabulous. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. This is an interesting topic as well, because so much is relying on, you know, websites these days, what's going on the internet, as opposed to face-to-face. Nobody walks by the store anymore. So let's talk about this. Tell us a bit about you and your background and what you do for business owners.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my background started in this specific business, building websites and helping people with their marketing. It actually started back when I had a separate business where I was going out actually hiring experts to build websites and help me with marketing and those types of things. And what I quickly learned and discovered was that a lot of the people out there building websites view them as a showcase piece. They love to build something that's beautiful, something that will get attention, maybe something that will win awards. But what I discovered very painfully and very expensively is that they knew very little about how to build a website that is actually going to help drive leads and drive sales into a company.
Okay. So, you know, everybody kind of, I think in the beginning was like, well, I'll put my website out because everybody has one, and maybe they put something together they think is beautiful, they don't realize that doesn't always work. You know, you have to attract attention for your website to become more than just a online brochure, right? Is that was kind of the beginning of everything, and then all the metrics of what attracts, what puts you in the top listings and all that kind of stuff has changed and evolved over the years. So why don't most websites help entrepreneurs reach their goals? Let's talk about that first.
Yeah, absolutely, Bill. You're so right. The evolution of, you know, kind of the way we present ourselves online has radically changed and shifted over the years. But here is mistake number one, and the thing that is most important for everyone to remember, and it's this, that a website is nothing more than a marketing tool. So when we begin treating our website as something different than that, when we begin thinking of our website as a showcase piece or as anything more than a marketing tool, we begin to lose focus on why it even exists in the first place. So, you know, the first mistake we see people making is they lose sight of that fact. They lose sight of the fact that it is a tool in your toolkit, your marketing toolkit, and it needs to be designed and it needs to be treated as exactly that. The next thing that we've kind of learned over the years, Bill, is that when people think about a website, they assume that everyone who comes to a website is the exact same. And so what we do is we end up treating people and talking to people and communicating with people in the exact same manner. And what we know to be true, and what you know to be true, if you think about your website, is that as people move further into the process of maybe just learning about you to actually pulling out their wallet and handing you money for your products or services, is that they experience or they go through your website in a little bit different ways. So for someone who lands on the homepage, for example, and then they leave, they may be just browsing. But if someone is reading the about page, or if someone is on the contact page, that person is now slightly different. Even though it may be the exact same person, that person is now slightly different than just the person visiting the homepage. And so when we approach our websites, we must approach visitors on each page as individuals, and we must make sure that the language, the text, everything that we're communicating on each subsequent page brings people down the path to where they trust us enough to pull out their wallet or to input their information to schedule a consultation or whatever that next step is in our buying process.
That's very interesting. That makes a lot of sense. That the first, you know, the first page is to make a first impression and draw people further into it. But once they get into it, then like what you're saying, that now you have someone who's slightly interested, but they're maybe looking for more analytical information or more details, and so those subsequent inside pages should be crafted differently. It makes a lot of sense. It seems like today a lot of people have gone away from 100 page websites to one really long page on the about that you keep scrolling down and there's different information on it and less information per page. Can you address that, you know, whether I'm correct or not about that, because that's been my observation?
Yeah, you are correct, Bill. And here's what we run into, the problem we run into as business owners is and marketers is that we end up copying what we see our competitors doing, believing that they made a wise decision or strategic decision in that effort. In other words, when we see a competitor take what used to be a massive website, let's just say a 100-page website, and they condense it down to a 10-page website, or we see a competitor who had maybe a 20-page website, and they have now instead taken it and converted it into a single page that's a much longer page, we assume that there's logic and sound judgment behind that decision. And the reality is that in most cases, that is not truth. That is not the truth. And so we must be careful. We must guard against this kind of reactionary response of when our competitor gets a new website that's beautiful and shiny and it has all this cool movement or, you know, whatever it may be, that we don't naturally assume that that is the thing that we should do. We shouldn't be outdone. They must have done some research. They must have, you know, made these changes for some strategic reason. Therefore, we should do the same. So we would save ourselves a lot of expense and a lot of trouble if we wouldn't allow that emotion to rule our judgment when it comes to our websites.
Makes sense. You know, I just think about it, the problem with when someone is required to click to, say, another page, they could also just as easily click to get out of your website. So I thought maybe that was behind it. Maybe a scroll is better than a click. I don't know. There's a lot of different things going on. You would know better. But what can people or should people do today to improve the results that they get from their website? What are some of the best tips you can give us there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm gonna give you a number, and the number is 353 or 353. So I'm gonna make some points about each of those. So the very first three is that we need to remember when we look at a website that design is made up of three C's. There are three C's when it comes to designing a website. The first one would be the composition. The next one would be the contrast. And then the final one would be the content. So contrast, composition, and content. Now, the order of those doesn't necessarily matter, but I can tell you this, when you go to most design companies, most designers, freelancers, your nephew, whoever it may be, chances are they love design. So they're going to lead this process of your new website with contrast and composition. So the contrast simply meaning the color variations, the shades, the textures that end up on the page. The composition part is the structure of the page, the layout of the page. And the very last thing that they typically think about is the content. But here's what you and I know. We know that our content, our message, is what matters the most. So the design should support our message, not the other way around. And unfortunately, most designers start the opposite way. They believe that the content should fit into whatever they design. So that's the first three in our 353. The three C's of design is the first one. The five is what we call the critical five. So when you approach your website, each page on your website, you should ask yourself these five questions. Who's here? What do I want them to do? When do I want them to do it? How do I want them to do it? And why should they do it? Not why should they do it from our perspective, but why should they take that action from their perspective? We call those the critical five. And here's what's so interesting, Bill. When we look at our website, we believe that those critical five change from page to page, as we already talked about earlier. When we approach our page, who's on our contact page, it's probably slightly different than who's just on the homepage. So we must use those critical five to go through page after page. And I'll just repeat them just briefly. Who's here? What do we want them to do? When do we want them to do it? How do we want them to do it? And lastly, why should they do it from their perspective? So that's the three, the five, and then the last three is this. Now more than ever, you only have about 3 seconds for someone to make a snap judgment about whether they want to stay on your website or not. Those 3 seconds, those initial 3 seconds, are crucial. That's why it's imperative that we understand our audience. We understand who it is that's going to be visiting our website and what that first 3 second experience is going to be like.
Wow, that's great. That's a great run through those major factors. You covered a lot of ground with the 353, and I appreciate that. Is there, you know, these days, have when you look at, let's say someone says, hey, Wayne, can you take a look at my website? How many times when you look at someone's website do you say, wow, that's great, nothing needs to be done?
Yeah, the answer is it happens more frequently than you think, and here's the reason. It's not that we couldn't fix or change or tweak or adjust a website. The reason is the motives coming into the conversation. It's very, very common. The number one reason people reach out to us asking for a new website is because a competitor of theirs just got a new website. And so that is completely the wrong motive. That is completely the wrong reason to begin the process of building a new website. Now, if that's the spark that leads you into a more strategic decision about our website is a tool, like we talked about a bit earlier, and this tool is not serving us well right now, how can we make this tool more effective and efficient for what it is that we do? At that point, we can have a meaningful and engaging conversation about redesigning, rebuilding a website from the ground up. So we want to work with people who understand that it's a tool and who understand that, you know, it does no good for us to say send 10,000 visitors to your website tomorrow if those 10,000 visitors aren't interested in what it is that you sell or what it is that you do, right? We would rather work with people who understand that if we can put your message, we can put this tool for you in front of the right people, the people who are interested in learning more about what it is that you provide or what it is that you do. You know, that's the people we want to work with. They're not enamored by numbers for the sake of numbers. They're enamored by results. Will the cash register ring at the end of the day?
Makes sense. And to start with that, they would start with their current metrics, right? Is it, what are my current results? Is it anywhere close to what I think it could be? Are there comparative metrics for every industry that you could point to and say, well, your current results aren't very good relative to what others in your industry are pointing to? There's all kinds of data out there. Is there data out there to support, you're not doing well or you're doing pretty good compared to your peers?
Yeah, there is all kinds of data, you're correct, Bill, that you can look at and see, but it gets very convoluted and very confusing very quickly. And the reason is people often are tracking the wrong metrics, right? They're tracking, for example, web traffic. That's a great metric. It's a great metric to track. But if you're not understanding what percentage of that web traffic is actually booking a consultation or what percentage of that web traffic is actually adding a product to the cart to begin the checkout process, you're tracking the wrong metrics. And so what we'd like to say is, let's establish a benchmark and a baseline for where you are today based on your actual data. And then month over month, let's improve those metrics every single month. Let's work to improve those metrics, because it doesn't do us any good to look around at the world around us if we're down here at ground zero and our competitor that we envy and want to be like is at, you know, the very top of the class. Sure, we can work that direction and we can look at their metrics, but again, we have to start with where we are today and make improvements each and every single day.
I'm looking at uglymugmarketing.com, which is your website, and I should have said that at the beginning of the show. Sorry, I didn't. uglymugmarketing.com, and it's very interesting. It starts with just a statement, when results matter, and has a lot of interesting video content behind it. And then each time you scroll down, it hits on one point, which is kind of what I was talking about earlier without having looked at your website, which is, you know, you don't want to overwhelm people today. And that's kind of where we're headed in general marketing these days, is you don't want to overwhelm people, because I know a lot of people, you look at their website and they try to jam everything on one page. And that just doesn't compel people as much as it used to, right?
You're exactly right. As our friend Donald Miller, the author of StoryBrand, says, if you confuse, you lose. So if people are confused when they land on any particular page of your website, you're going to lose their attention very quickly and on to the next site they go.
Yeah, it seems like that's the world we live in. Just Do It has been working just fine for Nike for a lot of years. And I think they were one of the first ones to really narrow it down to a very, you know, 8-letter or whatever it is, kind of a marketing campaign that became very effective. What other tips would you give our listeners as they think about looking at their website? What would you tell them, you know, a first step would be, as far as deciding whether they're getting the results that they want, and, you know, forget about what the competitor's doing. For instance, maybe if they haven't done anything in the last 3 or 4 years, that they should probably be looking at a refresh. Is there anything like that you can tell our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So generally speaking, you're about right. So 3 to 5 year window is typically when, from a big perspective, that the design styles have changed across the web. And so once your website reaches kind of that threshold, there's a chance that it's starting to feel a bit dated compared to the other sites that your audience may be looking at. So that is one that is very important. The other two, I would say, is this. So it's important to know the traffic coming to your website, in other words, how many visitors are coming. But two other metrics that matter more than that, if you don't sell directly on your website, would be the number of people who are actually calling you from your website. In other words, they're using the phone number there, they're clicking on the phone number on the top of your website or on the contact page. And the other would be the number of people who are either entering a funnel, a sales or marketing funnel from your website, or filling out some form of contact form. So again, what we're looking at here, we want to track the leads coming in through our website. And there's some simple ways that can be set up these days.
Wayne, very interesting content. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing some very valuable tips. The website is uglymugmarketing.com. Is that the best place for people to start thinking about working with you or looking at the type of work that you do?
Yep, that's the best place, Bill. All of our contact information is there and links to all of our social channels is there as well.
Really nice job with the 3-5-3, the 3 C's, the critical 5, and the 3 seconds. Really appreciate you keeping it simple for our listeners and providing such valuable information. And, you know, I would hope maybe you can come back, give us some more tips and the next quarter or so and keep us up to date on what we should be thinking about because it's an always changing environment.
Absolutely, Bill. I love the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. We have another guest today joining us, Billy Shepherd from Billy Shepherd & Associates. And Billy delivers a coaching experience that transforms how an actor acts and business people communicate. Clients have said it seems like she has a mysterious or supernatural power that influences the creativity, confidence, and best abilities of a speaker or performer. What Billy does is magical. Billy's been a professional actor for over 40 years, appearing in lead roles in Equity Productions, featured television appearances, and numerous national and regional commercials. An acting coach for decades, she's found 2 acting academies and 5 acting workshops in 4 states, and she's produced and hosts guest artist workshops, including such notable instructors as an Academy Award winner, Alan Arkin. 20 years ago, Billy had an idea. She founded Billy Shepherd & Associates, leveraging her acting experience and unique training methods into the business arena, transforming corporate speakers into influential leaders. And her clients include Facebook, Uber, Intuit, Rackspace, Lockheed Martin, as well as many financial and medical research companies. And this March, Billy had another idea. She merged her presentation training methods with the virtual needs of our times and created a powerful blend of the two, training business people how to enhance their virtual presentation skills. Her book, The Billy Shepherd Presentation Method, describing her methods and participant breakthrough stories of success, recently launched on Amazon. And Billy's a Dean Scholar with a BA in Creative Arts and Masters in Theater Arts from San Jose State University. So enough about Billy. Get her on the line. Billy, thanks for joining me today. Real pleasure to have you.
Oh, Bill, thank you for such a nice introduction. I was just listening away and so impressed with myself, I can't stand myself. Thank you.
Well, it's a very, you know,
so important.
You can't fit 40-plus years of experience into one sentence. So you've done a lot of incredible work, being a professional actor, being in lead roles, and now helping people to fine-tune their presentation skills. So let's talk about a little bit more about that. And how did you transform into this role that you have now?
The virtual training? I'm going to tell you, we'll start here. I didn't want to. I'm a spoiled brat, and I like to do what I do, and change rattles my cage. My life experiences haven't allowed me to do that, though. I've had to reinvent myself so many times, and the most recent was this virtual training. A very large company called me and said, when all this COVID hit, I'm in Silicon Valley in the Bay Area, and everybody jumped on Zoom. Can you help our company learn how to do Zoom? And I'll tell you, I said, you know, I really don't want to. I said, I know I should. My workshop is 2 days, 4 hours each day. It's an 8-hour in-person workshop with the groups of people. And I didn't want to do the Zoom thing. And they said, well, we'll give you a program manager and a tech person and we'll help you. And they were wonderful. And it almost buried me, but we did it. And here's what we discovered, that my methodology of what I was teaching in person, it turned out to be a beautiful marriage with Zoom and the virtual messaging. So it worked out great. Just briefly, I'll tell you that actors have to transfer their techniques from stage to camera and back from camera to stage. And now everybody else has to do it. Everybody else has to learn how to use the camera and be effective and use their voice effectively for Zoom. So it turned out great, and I love doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it, you're right. It's everybody has to turn into you're on camera. you have to act interested, and you can't just, twiddle away as a lot of people are used to doing on webinars and that type of thing, where, that's the biggest fear about doing a webinar is that people just aren't engaged. They're multitasking and they're not really looking. But on Zoom, you can see if someone's not interested. And so do you think that this change and helping people move into this new realm of presenting themselves will have long-lasting effects and change the way that they interact on an individual basis if we ever get back to normal?
Yes. Yes, and I underline the yes, because it's going to be with us. The Garland Research Company said that now we're at about 90% virtual presentation, and it'll drop back to, can believe this, 70%. So it's going to stay a while. It's going to be with us. There is a tremendous number of benefits to the Zoom too that will remain with us when we go back to in-person presenting and in-person one-on-one meetings and conversations and facilitations. And that is the intimacy of both the camera when one uses to learn it and use it properly by looking when to look in the camera and when to drop your slides and when to put your slides back, and the use of vocal modulation and clarity and the use of pauses. And when people enhance their vocal techniques, they will take that with them when they go in person with people. So these skills will, as you ask, continue on. It's a nice benefit. There are benefits. Rather than hating these Zoom meetings, I'm really learning to use techniques that help people get the intimacy from this machine.
Yes. And so let's talk about some of those techniques, if you will. For instance, a lot of people are saying when I first started doing Zoom meetings, eight months ago, let's say, for a lot of people, it was exciting. And then now I have something called Zoom fatigue. I'm just, and maybe that's because meetings aren't crafted properly. Maybe it's because they're too long. What are some of the tools and tips and techniques that you share with people to help them become better Zoom participants?
Oh, good question. A couple of things. People talk too much, myself included. Just ask my children. One of the things that's crucial for good Zoom or virtual communication is the ability to be concise and to learn how to edit. And people don't do that in their in-person meetings enough either. But in virtual meetings, the attention span is less, and people get fatigued if there is too much coming at them, and they even stop breathing. There's a Zoom apnea, they call it. So to learn to be concise and to learn to breathe while you're on these meetings is important. The other quality that we really realized when we were, developing this marriage between my methodology and this, the virtual work, is the importance of the voice and the importance of highs and lows and crisp diction and most importantly, I call it the sexiness of pauses, because when an important point is made and there is a brief pause, it allows the audience to digest and listen and digest the message and then bring what they're bringing to it. And then a collaboration can start. Actors learn to deliver lines and let that line land, making sure that the other actor is getting that message. And we need to do that with our virtual vocal technique too. Let the message land.
That's great advice. Is that what it's called in acting, the acting world? Let it land.
Let it land. And when you realize that the message has landed, their response will be much fuller back to you. And then it becomes what actors call unifying the audience, unifying the listener. And then it's a give and take. And then it's really communicating and collaborating with each other. The other way is just a yammering, isn't it? Just a bunch of information or a bunch of sounds. That's not the beauty of the voice or the face.
That's a good point. And I think a lot of us are watching a lot more maybe TV news, given the political events we've all been dealing with, and it's noticeable that the professional guests that come on intuitively speak for a certain period of time, a short period of time, and then they know that's the answer is over, and it goes back to the interviewer, the commentator. Is there a particular time frame, like you said, have a dialogue and share the content with one another? Is there a particular time frame that works best in the world of communication? For instance, is it a minute long, or we're programmed for 30-second and 60-second commercials? So I guess I'll turn that back over to you.
Well, that's interesting that you say that. There's a format that we teach, and it's how to answer impromptu questions. And that format, interestingly enough, allows for a natural time answering the question. If you put 10 seconds on it or 30 seconds on it, that's an artificial boundary that isn't as effective as being asked a question and saying, well, thank you for that question. And there are three reasons why I like acting. The first is I like bringing stories to people. The second is I like entertaining. And the third is it makes the world a better place. Formats, past, present, future included in the response, 1, 2, 3 reasons in the response, pros and cons is another way to go with the response. So I would say format allows our brain to keep from exploding, which always happens. Our brain explodes,
right.
And then we either start talking too much or we go completely blank and look like a deer in the headlights. But if we choose a format, we will answer in a good timely manner and consistent.
That's great. Now your technique, one of your techniques, is called the present moment awareness. And something interesting happens when people practice present moment awareness that affects a lot of people when it comes to public speaking. You say their fear evaporates. What do you mean by that? And how prevalent is fear in people with their, especially visual communications?
I wouldn't say it's prevalent. I would say it's omnipresent. I've been acting for over 40 years, and I have never worked with an actor that I respected that didn't have nerves or fear before they go in front of a camera, before we go on stage. It's our amygdala and that part of our limbic telling us that we're going to face a tribe intent on cooking us and eating us for dinner. But the the brain can be instructed that we're actually in control of our nerves, and to do that, we need to prepare. We need to get in this present moment where we're not worried about the future or regretting the past. We're in this present moment before we go on stage. And to do that, actors take in deep breaths, we tense, release, some jump rope, some meditate a little bit. We've got to prepare, and any performer has to prepare, including, of course, a speaker. One has to prepare. And most of the time, people don't know these techniques, and when they apply them, they realize, oh, I had zero fear. No fear, because there's no room for the fear in the present moment. It takes up space in our entire machinery from top of our head to the tip of our toes. We'll be in the moment.
How prevalent is these days is the use of props? I mean, a lot of people have said PowerPoint is dead. Others say long live PowerPoint. it helps them. How important is it? I mean, we certainly have gone from a information packed slide to a picture being worth 1,000 words on a slide and a minimal content. What tips would you give people as far as when they're presenting and their visual aids to engage them and use them most effectively?
They're there to support you. And if a slide supports what you're saying and the message you're trying to impart, use a good slide. If a prop supports what you're trying to say and the message you're trying to impart, use a prop. There's a wonderful artist named Hans Hoffman, and he has a great quote about what to leave in and what to take out. And he says, to simplify, eliminate the unnecessary so that the necessary may speak. And when we stick to that quote, we'll see the slide and we'll say, I don't need that slide. It's kind of dragging this down. Or, you know what would help here? A slide of the numbers that happened in the third quarter. You will know. Eliminate the unnecessary so the necessary may speak.
Very good. I like that. Now, you have a success story that you wanted to share, I think, today, ahead of a division of a major company that was originally shy and nervous and disorganized. And after working with you, they now speak globally. Tell us a little bit about the beginning and how that worked and what was needed in that type of a situation for that individual to become a star.
Oh, lovely, lovely. Well, when I first met this gentleman, I think he was 6'6", just an enormous, beautiful man. And he came in and he headed this huge division in this huge company, and he couldn't look me in the eyes. And he was very shy, and I'm not an intimidating presence initially. I'm very tiny. He was very intimidated by having to work on his presentations, as most people are. It's scary. People are scared. And he was very shy. And what typically happens is people talk too much when they're presenting, when they're shy. I call it their wall of words. And he talked too much, and he paced all over, and he didn't look people in the eyes, and he was a mess. And he was such a lovely, giving person. And we worked together, and he was wonderful to coach. I always say that when they do everything that I tell them. But he was wonderful to coach, and he did what I advised. And little by little, he improved. And then all of a sudden, One time he went up on the stage, he was going to deliver to an all-hands meeting, and he was this amazing person, and he just played the role, which was a big part of the training with him, is that he chose the role of a benevolent king, and that was the leader he wanted to be. He wanted to be a king, but he wanted to be a benevolent one. And that was the leader he chose, and that's who he became. And then he went on globally, making presentations all over the place. He worked real hard. I have the greatest job in the world. I get to share this information that I spent my life learning because of joy and passion, and I was so attracted to it, and I get to give it to people and then watch them become brilliant. It's the greatest job.
Well, not only do you share that and transform people, but you've transformed yourself. So you're basically your own best client, right?
Thank you, Bill. The way you reinvented
yourself.
So
we have a couple minutes left, but tell us, you have a great tip for our audience about the best investment they can ever make. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, there is. Oh my gosh, his name totally escapes me. Warren Buffett, how can I forget him? And I was online and I was looking around and it said Warren Buffett's greatest tip. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll look it up. Maybe he's got a stock tip, you know. And I looked it up and he was saying the investment you'll ever make is in yourself. Learn how to communicate. And I thought, he is the greatest. And I say to people, invest in yourself. Learn how to communicate virtually. It's going to be with us a long time. Learn how to enjoy it and deliver your messages so you enjoy it and your listeners enjoy it.
Excellent, excellent. So for our listeners, to find out more information about that, about your methods, Billy, you have a website, www.billyshepherd, and I'll spell that for our listeners, BILLIESHEPARD, BILLIESHEPARD.com. And, of course, your book is out, The Billy Shepherd Presentation Method, now available on Amazon. Hey, everybody, Christmas is coming. Great time to help others invest in themselves by making a gift of the Billy Shepherd presentation method. And it's wonderful to talk with you and hear about, get to know you, hear about some of your successes and techniques. And I wish you all this success in the world, in the upcoming world. Thank you for helping our listeners to understand more about how they can communicate better and for all that you do.
Thank you, Bill. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure to have you with us on the show today. That's going to do it for ExaCoach Radio today. We look forward to talking with you again very soon with another great cast of guests.
Hey, everybody. It's Bill Black, the ExaCoach from the ExaCoach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.